We were talking about the matrix elements of the quantum geometric tensor, and we discovered that, okay, so if we have this matrix G mu nu, remember mu and nu are the coordinates in the manifold M of parameters. And we think that phi, being the eigenstate of highest eigenvalue for this metric, this will have some components.
Sorry.
Yeah.
How many eigenstate will have? Is it two? Oh, I mean the number of the parameter.
Right. So this is a n by n matrix. Symmetric.
Oh.
So it will have n eigenstates and eigenvalues.
The small n is.
It would be two for the xy model, for instance.
Yes. So two by two for the xy model.
For the xy model. Oh. Yeah. But now I'm saying something general, okay? Of all these eigenstates, one of them will have a maximum eigenvalue. It's the one that we call phi. And in a generic basis, in mu, we'll have some components. Okay, so where we are defining this? Because we are interested in the maximum expectation value that this matrix can have, the maximum matrix elements that it can have. And so, we also we are interested in this object, right? This is what we had inside our metric tensor, and we want to sum over all the components. Okay, so the maximum weight that this object can have in the mu nu space is phi mu. So we sum over mu, we have this, okay? Now, this is a scalar in the mu nu space. In the Hilbert space, what is this? Is it, what is it? Huh? It's an operator, right? Because for every mu, the mu h is an operator. And this is just a sum of operators, linear combinations of operators. Okay, so this is what has either expectation values or matrix elements in the Hilbert space. Okay, and we are interested in the expectation value of this object in the ground state. So this is the quantity that appears in the bound for these matrix elements. I'm just repeating the last part of yesterday's lecture, and we found out that this can be upper bounded by the gap with the first excited state to the minus two. Okay, let me call it epsilon one. What did I call it before? Delta? Okay. And then we have the fluctuations of this object. Okay. So I for ease of notation, yesterday I think I called this operator, I called it delta H. So now this will be here, the expectation value of delta H square inside zero minus the square of the expectation value. Okay? So this is the result we arrived at yesterday. It is already a very compelling result because it tells us, imagine that I have a gap. Then this is finite. then if I want to argue that my Jimmy Nu does not diverge, then all I need to bound are these fluctuations. Okay? So let's go on. At this point, we introduce one element that is always underlying and that will play a bigger and bigger role in the next hours, which is locality. Let me see the notation I use. Okay. This means that this operator must be a local operator, right? Like all the operators in our theory. And you see, this must be a local operator because this is just the linear combination of the derivatives of the Hamiltonian with respect to the parameters. And the Hamiltonian is the sum of local operators. So also this is the sum of local operators. And I will use this notation. So J is a label that is labeling the local support of delta V. Is what, in other contexts, I called capital X. Remember when we were talking about the Hamiltonian? Okay, is it clear what this J is? Okay, so now let's just plug this in. What we get here is this. Then you will have the sum over I and J of delta VI square, say zero, minus delta VI delta VJ. Sorry, I should have written this. Okay, now, like we did before in some our earlier discussion about correlation functions, see, this is the sum of correlation functions. Remember that we wrote the magnetic susceptibility as a sum of correlation functions. Now, we can say that again, we have some rotational invariance and translational invariance, okay? So that doesn't matter what is the starting site I, right? We can substitute it with some specific site zero. And if you do that, here you have the gap. And then here you get the volume of your space, right? Because this is summed over all the volume. It's not a chain anymore. And the volume will be some length scale to the power d. And then you have the sum of correlation functions, CR. Connected correlation functions, CR.
So you are assuming rotation invariance and translation.
Yes, correct. Right now I am rotational, and I said it, but I didn't write it, and translation. Because now we are in a volume, so we need all the possible invariances, spatial invariances. Okay? Okay. So this is the important result, okay? So we know for a fact that these matrix elements are upper bounded by this. Now, if there is a finite correlation length psi, which means that all correlation functions decay like e to the minus r over xi, then this object can be summed and is upper bounded by a real number c. So if there is a finite xi, then this is upper bounded by cl to the d delta to the minus 2. And that at this point, our rescaled metric tensor, so we have to divide by the volume. In the case of the XY model, it was a one-dimensional model. We were dividing by the number of spins n that was also L. Okay. This will be upper bounded by this. Okay. So you see the role that the gap and the correlation length play. So if the gap is finite, and there is a finite correlation length, then we are assured that this does not diverge. Let's compare this result with what we know from the quantum XY model. In the quantum XY model, when there is a gap, so away from the so-called critical point, how is the correlation length? At the critical point, right? But let's think about the paramagnetic phase. In the paramagnetic phase, where you have a finite correlation length, you also have a gap, and therefore this cannot diverge. Okay? And you see that in the ferromagnetic case, the situation is a bit different because we do not have a finite correlation length, because at least for the in the symmetric state, we have a long range order. Okay? But this is okay because we are only looking for sufficient conditions right now for this to not diverge. So what we learn from here is compatible with all we have. Okay. So xi and delta are the elements that play an important role. If you have finite xi and finite delta, then you're ensured that this is not diverging. But it could happen that in spite of having a divergent xi or a zero gap, those are still bounded. Okay, it's not a necessary condition. So again, for instance, in the ferromagnetic phase, you have long range order, but they are still bounded in the ferromagnetic phase. However, they are not at the critical point. Okay? So what we are looking for in this lecture and next is a way of understanding for what conditions, when is xi finite? Okay? It's what we would like to know. you see that in the paramagnetic phase where psi is finite, the accompanying conditions for psi being finite are there is a gap, and the ground state is unique. In other words, no symmetry breaking. Because symmetry breaking means you have more than one state. If you have more than one state, the symmetric state will have a long range order. So it would be nice to thinking that these two are actually just the sufficient, at least sufficient conditions for psi being finite. Okay, so this is what we would like to know. And then we would like to understand whether, so we would like to prove this, and we would like to understand if also the other way around is true. Notice that if also the other way around is true, then long range order if the other way around is true, then it is not the case that you have a degeneracy and a finite correlation length. Okay? So this means that every time you have a degeneracy, then you have long range order, which pretty much means only symmetry counts, because this is what breaking of symmetry has shown us, that when you make a superposition of a symmetric superposition of your symmetry breaking states, then you have a long range order. Okay. So we don't know if is it possible to have a degeneracy plus gap resulting in psi finite. So we cannot exclude this for now. But if we are talking about symmetry breaking, then the degeneracy and gap always implies long range order. So if we can exclude this, then there is nothing beyond symmetry break. Is the logic clear? Long range order means that psi is not fine. So correlation length, correlation functions are not decaying. Okay. To this end, we would like to prove that indeed this implication is true, but that that is not true. Okay? So to prove this theorem, we will resort on locality. So it's only true for local Hamiltonians, which is great, because we know that something about correlations is only meaningful when you have a local Hamiltonian. Right, because correlations are correlations between parts, and if your theory is non-local, the notion of parts is meaningless. Okay, so locality is important, as we know, and I need to prove an intermediate result to prove this theorem, which is by itself an amazing result, okay? Which by itself is a very important topic in quantum matter. So Let me give you an example. Imagine we are on our Ising or quantum XY model or any other local model, and we prepare our state in the ground state of H for some value of the parameters, okay? I'm not writing now the parameters. We froze those parameters. So for t smaller than t0, we are in this state, which is the ground state. Then suddenly, at t equal to t0, we do the so-called local quantum quench. What is it? We suddenly change H from H plus VI, where VI is an Hermitian operator that has a support only on the region labeled by I. So if you are thinking of a chain, there is no loss of generality of thinking of a chain. Let's say that this is the site I. Now, question, after this local quantum quench, will your state psi for t greater than t0, will it be constant or it will evolve in time? What do you think? It will evolve because generically psi zero is not an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian anymore, right? Unless I chose VI very carefully. So we should assume that in any case, it will evolve like this. Okay. So it will have some time evolution. Now imagine that I make a measurement at the site J. Okay? So what does it mean to make a measurement of the site at the site J? It means that I have an operator O that has this form, is some operator OJ at the site J, tensor, the identity everywhere else. So let me call this J bar, means everywhere else, the complement of J. So I'm making a measurement of this means that I will have some expectation value. And this expectation value, let me call it O without the hat of T, will be the trace in psi of T of O hat. Okay. And now I ask you this question. How long, because you see, for t smaller than t0, we were in an eigenstate, so nothing was evolving. So whatever I measure everywhere until t0 is constant in time, right? Then at t0, I mess up here, just here. And I ask, how long should I wait to see something here? So when definitely when t is smaller than t0, this number is constant. So if this t, this is t0, this is OT. And then at some point, I should see something, right? And I'm asking you, what is this time tau minus t0? and I want to know what you think. What do you think?
Time takes for AI to grow sufficiently so that it reaches the side chain in the Heisenberg picture.
This is a great answer. So you said, what is that has to grow? What is that has to grow?
VI in the Heisenberg picture, the support of VI.
Okay, so great. So that's a great answer. And let me rephrase it in an equivalent way that is just slightly more clear. So your colleague said that VI is local, but VI of T will grow, or this is all, which is the same also, O of T will grow. But yeah, I like the picture. VI of T will grow, and at some point will hit J. So we need to know how fast it grows. So this is the idea, and I like it very much. And as very justly your colleague said, VI of T is, we know what it is by the Heisenberg picture. So let me call, for ease of notation, this Hamiltonian H prime. It will be e to the I H prime T VI e to the minus I H prime T. Okay. Now question, because we want to know for what T the support of VIT will hit J, right? This is what we said. So what do you think that is the support of this operator? Is the support of this operator, right? Because this is I dressed by this one. And what is the support of this operator? So expand this. This is an exponential. So because H prime is the sum of local operators, when you take the powers of H, you will have all the possible products of elements of H of any length. So the support of this is the full Hilbert space. This is a bit troubling, right? Because your colleague's idea makes so much sense that it is very disturbing that it looks like, oh, we cannot do that. But this is true. This support is the full Hilbert space. So first of all, we need to come to terms with the fact that, oh my God, immediately I can send a signal from I to J. We know how bad this is. So first of all, we need to come to terms with this. After we come to terms with this, we need to find a way to save your colleague's idea. Okay, but first, why do we have instant signaling? Okay, you must be able to answer this question. Let's say that we cannot save your colleague's idea. Okay, too bad, it was a great idea, doesn't work. Oh, but now we have worse problems, right? We have instant signaling. So why we are fine, why we are not, you know, changing job at this point, because all we do is based on, why we think that, you know, even if this lecture ends right now, you know, you can go home and still think that, you know, physics makes sense. Don't look for a complicated answer. There is a simple answer.
We don't know how far I jam.
No, right, but you see, this argument does not depend on how far I and J are. No matter how far they are, for every T, the support is everywhere. So it looks really bad.
I mean, exactly at T to zero, there's support only at one location.
Yeah.
Suddenly we have like just a tiny value of T. It doesn't mean that the support will blow up to the entire Hilbert space.
Okay. I agree. So your colleague really feels very strongly about her idea, and she's right. So she's saying, you know, maybe the support is everywhere, but this influence is tiny, and if I do some approximation, it looks like actually takes some time. She's very right, okay? However, an approximation is an approximation. I mean, you are still able, in principle, to send a tiny signal. And this is enough to feel very troubled, okay? So let's solve this problem first, and then let's see if we can go through with your idea.
We should take a commutator out too.
Huh?
We should consider about commutator instead of the support.
No, the answer to why we have signaling is easy. What do you think?
I think because of the quantum quench.
No.
Because we are here considering non-relativistic theory.
Yes. This is not a relativistic theory. We know it's wrong. This is ordinary quantum mechanics, which is not relativistic, which means, there is no light cone. This is an easy way to show you that we need the relativistic theory. So that's why we go through these pains of doing quantum field theory and defining, imposing Lorentz invariance, saying that, you know, operators have to commute when they are away, when one is away from the light cone of the other one, right? Okay, so you see, there is no light cone, of course. So now this solution is so clear, then we were so disturbed. Now we feel so safe. But we feel so safe that now suddenly your colleague's idea doesn't seem so solid anymore. Because if your colleague was right, then it would be possible to have a light cone without putting a light cone. Right? I have a theory where there is no light cone. But then somehow, this light cone comes out, or to use a fancy word, emerges. Which means, actually, I don't need to do a relativistic quantum theory. It's already there. It's hidden, but it emerges. Which would be amazing, right? It would be fantastic. So your colleague is right. So we do have an emergent light cone. So this is what we are moving to prove. Emergence of a light cone. So the emergence of a light cone is a consequence of a series of theorems that go under the collective name of Lieb-Robinson bounds. So these are theorems in the sense that you can prove similar bounds under a wide a range of hypotheses. Some are weaker, some are stronger. Today, I will give you the proof of the stronger of the weaker theory means the one with the strongest hypothesis, which is also the easiest one to prove. All the other proofs go along similar lines, but they can get much more complicated, of course, although the basic idea is the same. And we will comment at the end about what hypothesis you can relax, actually. So the hypothesis that we make for this one will be this. Okay. First of all, we have a local quantum system . Okay, we know everything about this. We know that this is the sum of local operators. Let me now be specific. Lambda is our set of points. And this is a bounded operator over H lambda. And because this is a bounded operator, then this means that all these local terms are upper bounded by some number. Let me call this number small h. Okay? And then we have two requests on locality. One is that the volume of x is upper bounded by some number that I will call sigma. And the other one is that the diameter of x will be upper bounded by some number that I will call capital R. Okay? So these are, I don't need to explain this because we've been dealing with this for a while. Okay. And now what we look at is so this is our set lambda. Now we want to look at two regions, A and B, that are disjoint. They're not necessarily disjoint. Let me define things. Anyway, think of them as disjoint with a graph distance dAB. Okay, you know what is the graph distance. If dAB is zero, means that they are overlapping, okay? But generally, if dAB is greater than zero, this means they are disjoint. Now, let's consider operators A. So this means this is an operator on HA, the Hilbert space corresponding to these degrees of freedom, and B. Okay, question for you. What is this commutator between A and B?
Zero.
Zero, good. Okay. Now, of course, if we have a system that is evolving in time, okay, then, for instance, A would be evolving in time. And like your colleagues told us, this time evolution of this operator is given by the Heisenberg picture. Okay, so now in the following, I will drop the hat over A and B. In the notes, there is the hat, but I don't remember. Anyway, from now on, I'm talking about the operators A and B, okay? Not the expectation values of the operators A and B. And the object of our interest is this function, f of t, which is an operator-valued function, which is the commutator between A of t and B. Notice it's B, not B of t. Okay? So this is a definition, and my promise is that this is the object that is involved in evaluating how large is the signal that reaches B if I do something in A. It is also the object that is involved in a question that is related, that has to do with what your colleague said. They said, okay, if I have some operator that is local, but now with the time it will grow, okay, and so this length should be vt. So at t equals 0, the support is just this. At time t, its support should be this. Well, actually, we have just said that the support is everywhere. What we mean is that outside here, the contribution of that support is very small. Basically means that if I truncate here, my operator, I don't make a big error. So these are the things that we are interested in showing that they would happen without putting a light cone. But that the light cone emerges, that basically there is a V associated without putting the speed of light C anywhere, without imposing that it's a relativistically invariant. Okay. So in order to show all these things, the object of interest is this one. Okay? In particular, we will produce a very strong bound on the norm of this. So we'll show that this operator is very small if t is smaller than some length, some L over V, which means that there is a light cone. Okay?
But you are defining a light cone with respect to an arrow, right?
I'm defining a light cone with?
With a respect to an arrow bar.
With an arrow bar?
Yeah.
So it's an approximate light cone.
Yeah.
But I want to, well, you'll see how the error is. Okay? Yes, there is an error. It's an approximate light cone, and then we will see how big is the error. And, you know, in the one of the insights from quantum information is that we don't just say, hey, this is a good approximation, and then we don't know very much what to say about slight deviations from these approximations that might have a high conceptual value, like, hey, there is a little signal. We actually say how good the approximation is. And if this approximation is mind-bogglingly good, then this means that there is, you know, it is as good as if it were exact, because you do not have the experimental capability of seeing a correction, right? Okay, so let's proceed. So as you know, we have a second lecture at 2. Where we finish this proof. I start now. Okay, yeah?
Sorry, we're not saying the speed of light will emerge from this, right? It's just some speed will.
Great, yes. It will emerge a maximum speed.
Right.
And if in a physical system you have a maximum speed, it defines a causal structure. And I can, you know, with some abuse of language, call it a light cone. Oh, of course, it is not light. But so now imagine that you had a spin system such that the excitations of this theory, just like in our spin chain, there are free fermions. imagine that these excitations were spin zero particles that behave like photons, that they're photons. And they have a speed of propagation, okay? This is actually possible. So Professor Xiaogang Wen, who is at MIT, and he was at PI for a while at some point, actually invented this beautiful theory. It's just spins, and the excitations of these spins are photons. Okay. This is sort of going back in the past, because then the system of spins is actually ether, right? It's a mechanical theory where you have local degrees of freedom, and then the excitations of this mechanical medium are your photons. And so they have the speed of light, right? By definition, you call speed of light the speed of these objects. And now you ask, okay, but this is not a relativistic invariant theory, actually. It's not, right? There is ether, it's not relativistically invariant. But now you ask, is it possible that this speed is also the maximum possible speed in this system? And the answer is yes. Okay, so basically applying this type of theorem to this theory of Xiaogang Wen, one could prove that. Yeah,
so what would be the maximum speed? I think in general, the speed of this perturbation will depend on the A and B. So I think the...
Very good. I'll show you. Oh. I'll show. The theorem is about showing that there is actually a maximum speed of interactions. Okay? So without further ado, let's prove this. Okay. So we have our F. So one thing that we can do is a very clever trick that mathematical physicists do. Let's take the derivative of F. Okay. Now you see what is F, right? It's the commutator of is an operator. Okay, it's an operator. It's an operator written in the Heisenberg picture. Okay. The part that depends on time is A. So you would remember, so the time derivative of this is just the time derivative of this. And you would remember that it's very easy to take time derivatives of operators in the Heisenberg picture because they're given by the commutator with the Hamiltonian. So this is I, the commutator of H with A of T, and then commuted with B. So far, so good. Now, let's call, so A of T is given by that, right? And let me call, I'm too short. Let me call E to the minus IHT, let me just call it U. Okay, it's our unitary operator that defines the time evolution. And what do you think of the commutation relationship between H and U?
Zero.
No, but I cannot hear you.
Zero.
They commute.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm deaf. You have to raise your voice. Okay, so it means that H is equal to U dagger HU. Okay. So this means that I can write this thing in this way. Oh, no, you should correct me. This is not A of t anymore. Right? I took it out of the time dependence. Do you understand this passage, all of you? Okay. Now, remember what is H. In fact, I want to do this later. No, let me do one passage first. Okay. No, that's fine. Sorry. That's fine. Okay. Now you see something. So what are phi axes? Phi axes, so these axes are patches in lambda, right? Are our local interactions. If this is our graph, the axes are these local interactions that are everywhere, right? But each of them has a support that, so it's small in volume and it's limited also in length, right? So what happens if psi intersect A is the empty set? What would happen? They would commute, okay? So this means that we can restrict our sum here to only those axes that have a non-null intersection with A. So let me call this set, let me call zeta 1 is the set of subsets of lambda such that, so let me call these elements x1, such that x1 intersect with A is different from the empty set. So now I can restrict this sum in this way. Do you agree? So this is phi x1. Okay, so now I can put back my unitary operators and get I, this sum over x1 in z1, phi x1 of t, A of t, commutator B. Do you agree? Okay. New thing I can do, I can apply Jacobi identity on commutators. So you know that the commutator of A and B with the C plus the commutator of BC with A plus C with AB is zero, right? It's actually the same rule of the cross product. So let me just do that. So this is I, the sum over x1. Let me copy the terms in the right order. Fx1 t commutator A of t b plus A of t commutator b phi x1 of t, Okay, and I close this parenthesis. Okay, this is good. Now we notice something, that this object is f. Okay? So you see, we have an equation that says f prime is something that I do to f. What is that I do to f? I commute it with this operator, and then I sum over all these things. Plus some other object that is also an operator. So let me call this object G, and whatever operation I'm doing on F, let me call it L. So we have this equation, F prime is equal LF plus G. Now, question for you. This L and G, mathematically, what kind of objects are they? Are they linear or not? They are, right? I see you nodding. Because all I'm doing is taking commutators and summing. And here, too, I'm taking commutators and summing. Okay? So you see that this is a first-order linear equation where you have these operators. So there is a standard way to solve these differential equations that is called variation of constants or of parameters. So by the way, the operator L, L operates on dot by, what is it? I commutator with H1, like this. H1 is this sum. It's an Hamiltonian, right? Because it's the sum of remission operators that are bounded. Okay, yeah?
At this kind of definition, should we define something like the algebra? Because it's I think it's basically the same thing. Yes, take the multiplication to be the Lie bracket.
Yeah.
It's exactly the Lie algebra.
Mm-hmm.
So should we have some like geometry things?
So I'm invoking something less sophisticated than this. I'm just solving this first order differential equation. What I will show is that if there is a solution to the homogeneous equation, then what you do, you just sum to the solution a particular solution of the inhomogeneous equation, and this particular solution, because of the variation of parameters, has the form that you divide by, let me just write it, because you will recognize it. Yeah.
Are we sure we can say that G is independent of F? We recognize F in the part where it's L, but in G, I'm not sure it's
to make the equation linear, you have to convince that G is just something irrelevant.
The point is that even if G I know this is not a proof, but I don't see how G contains F. How G would depend on F. So I think the point is that it does not explicitly depend on F. If it depends on F implicitly, that's not a problem. Yeah. Okay. So the homogeneous equation is just F prime equal LF. And as you can see, F prime equal LF, where L is this, is just the Schrödinger equation. Right? In the Heisenberg picture.
Which one contains T? It depends on T, which one?
Yeah, sure.
Time dependent.
Fine. Okay? So it is some time dependent Schrödinger equation that has some solution. And I will call this mapping, that is the solution to the homogeneous equation, I will call it gamma. So let me call gamma T, as you said, depends on time, is the mapping that takes f of 0 and maps it to f of t equal gamma t f of 0. Yeah?
Did our initial Hamiltonian depend on time when we undid the time dependence in A? Then we kind of got the time dependence into the Hamiltonian?
So the initial Hamiltonian does not depend on time. Is H.
Yes. And then when you open that up and then brought it back, then.
Well, if it didn't depend on time, if it didn't depend on time, it doesn't depend on time, right? No matter what I do.
Yeah, okay.
So the only reason, I mean, the answer to your question is this, which is another way of saying does not depend on time.
Okay.
This is H of T. And h of t is a constant. Okay. Okay. So, of course, this solution can be very complicated. We know that integrating the Schrödinger equation is very complicated because we need to be able to diagonalize a matrix that can have, you know, n squared, where n is the dimension of the Hilbert space. However, we do know something about this mapping, that it is unitary, right? We know that. It must be unitary because this operator is Hermitian. We know that the formal solution, in other words, is the exponentiation of e to the I, an Hermitian operator, so it must be unitary. And if it is unitary, then Ft in norm, which is gamma T F0, will be just F0 in norm. Because unitary operations are norm preserving. Okay, so remember that our goal is eventually to find a bound on that thing, okay? So we will use this property a lot. Okay, so if our equation was just the homogeneous equation, we would be finished, right? That's it, right? This is our solution, and this is it, and it's not very interesting. Because it just says, oh, you know, if they commute at the beginning, so their norm is zero, they will commute at every t. But this is not the case, right? We also have these terms. They cannot not be there. So we really need to look at the solution of the full equation. So let me write this solution, and then we stop to reconvene at 2. Oh, okay, maybe I can write it here. So the solution of the general inhomogeneous equation will be given by this one, which is the solution to the homogeneous equation, plus a particular solution of the inhomogeneous equation, which is gamma t times the integral between 0 and t of gamma in some variable s1. I'm putting it here as a substitute. At the denominator, this is the variation of parameters, times gs1 in the s1. And let me cross the parentheses. Okay. So you see, it's not just this. It's this plus this. Last thing, therefore, I can produce this bound. I can say that the norm of f of t is upper bounded by the norm of all this piece. Okay. But now we remember gamma. Gamma is norm preserving. So I can just ignore gamma everywhere. So this is upper bounded by the norm of f of 0, which we knew, plus the norm of the rest. And then I use a triangular inequality, which means I can pass the norm under the sine of integral and get another upper bound. And now I have this guy. Okay? Okay, so we stop here. When we reconvene at 2, we start thinking about how to bound this operator G, okay? And we'll see what happens.